Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 19th of July 2015. My name is DRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Julie Raby, Tim from the Civilian Theatre, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Orson's Shadow at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a play by Austin Pendleton based more or less on true events. It's set in 1960 when Orson Welles, in the declining end of his career, is persuaded, with help from Kenneth Tynan, to direct Laurence Olivier and Joan Plowright in UNESCO's Rhinoceros. This is a rather important time for Laurence Olivier because he has gone from being a rather old-fashioned actor in sort of the days of the Angry Young Men to becoming much more respected and with the prospect of being able to found the National Theatre, because what he did to do that was appear in John Osborne's play The Entertainer, and he starred in it along with a young actress called Joan Plowright, with whom he fell in love, and we see kind of the results of this. The rather unfortunate thing, of course, is that Laurence Olivier has, I've almost said, a mad woman in the attic, but it isn't. It is Vivian Leigh. Her mental state is, shall we say, fragile, but that's probably just code for miserable and rather drunk, and sort of knowing that perhaps her relationship with Laurence Olivier is over and not really facing up to it yet, and Laurence Olivier hasn't quite got round to telling him, which is this is all mixed into the play, but the play is an awful lot about Orson Welles and his attempts to direct this play while Laurence Olivier is giving tips to actors behind the scenes, which annoys people. Julie, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was really the four characters, wasn't it? Well, five: Joan Plowright, Vivian Leigh, Ken Tynan, Orson Welles and Laurence Olivier, and they're holding the stage for the 2 hours. I thought it was, as you were saying, interesting, but I didn't think it was brilliant. I did love going and seeing it, and I was really curious to see what they do with the material. I think the problem was there wasn't anywhere that you could take it. So you had Tynan as this kind of middleman trying to get Orson Welles and Laurence Olivier together, so Orson Welles could direct Laurence Olivier in this UNESCO play. I wasn't sure if it was actually based on a true story or it was bits of fact mixed up with fiction. I think it was more of a fiction to bring these characters together. And it kind of set out to break down some assumptions around watching plays, that you're going to get all this info done. But actually what happens is most of the play is a bit of an info dump. I thought there was a good performance from Ed Bennett as Ken Tynan, because he's kind of on stage all the time and he doesn't always have a lot to say. So there's lots of moments where he has to sit there uncomfortably listening to conversations between Laurence Olivier and Joan Plowright, or Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. There's a moment where they have a conversation on the telephone and then that turns into them meeting face to face in the moment. And Tynan's there and he has to kind of show some interest, and then he has to pretend that he's not listening, and then he has to look uncomfortable as these conversations are going on. And I thought Ed Bennett made a really good job of that. I think it was a shame there wasn't a bit more drama involved. I thought, you know, with the Vivian Leigh, it was too much about her illness rather than the moments of them together. So I didn't think that actually worked very well. But it was an enjoyable evening. I just wasn't sure where it was going to go and how it was going to end, and really it ended telling you the history of the characters and what happened to them, but you didn't actually see much drama in the play itself. I don't know what you thought.
Before I start on that, I did forget, of course, to mention the other actors. We've got John Hodgkinson as Orson Welles, Adrian Lucas as Laurence Olivier, Louise Ford as Joan Plowright, Gina Bellman, I think you mentioned, as Vivian Leigh, and we also have Kieran O'Brien as a sort of stagehand who can ask daft questions and to whom information can be imparted. I thought that this was, as I said before, an interesting play. It's one of those ones where they are, as you said, just dumping information at you. They're telling stuff, but they're not really getting into it. The actors didn't really try to do impressions of the people they were playing too much. There's enough footage of Orson Welles and Laurence Olivier, of course, and, you know, every actor has a Laurence Olivier impression in their knapsack. And you could also even do Kenneth Tynan and Joan Plowright if you did a bit, little bit more research. So you could get the impersonations very accurate if you wanted to. But I don't think they did here. I think the imaginary parts of the play is the whole involvement with Kenneth Tynan and the whole motivation of Kenneth Tynan. Kenneth Tynan basically wants the job he eventually got as the sort of literary manager at the National Theatre. He was the sort of working backstage with Olivier to decide what plays they put on. And he did that for, I think, about 10 years in the end. He was quite influential in that space. So it's sort of bringing Kenneth Tynan into the mix as a narrator character is what they did, I think, is the sort of the fictionalized part of this play. But certainly the production of Ionesco's Rhinoceros did go ahead. I've seen the posters for it at the Royal Court. They have some old posters on the wall. I'm fairly sure it was directed by Orson Welles and by Laurence Olivier. I think the writer has, Austin Pendleton, who did this back in 1980, he's depending too much on our knowledge of these people. They're not doing impersonations, but he is relying on you knowing all about these people and being interested in these people. And I'm fascinated with these people, but I really didn't get enough from them. It didn't enhance my knowledge. It didn't make me feel that he was doing other than just saying, well, look, here they are on the stage. I don't really know what they did, but here they are. They are interesting people. They got together. It didn't really do anything other than just put them there. It didn't get into the depths. There is a nasty, great story to be, you know, filmed about the relationship between Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier. I think we might have to wait a while for that to happen, libel lawyers being what they are. He is a fascinating character and fascinating study, Laurence Olivier, in his personal life as well as an actor. And I don't think we get any of that here. I mean, it is really tough. We have to remember, I think, this is an American play and with largely British subjects, and I don't think he really gets them. He really gets into them. He's rather better with Orson Welles, but he just seems to be making quotes from Orson Welles and Orson Welles' biography. He's not really getting into who Orson Welles is. And of course, Orson Welles is a fascinating character who constantly reinvented himself, which is possibly why you can't really get into the soul of the man, because he is always reinventing, always being different. All in all, I mean, an interesting play. It's got a very good cast, but yeah, I was not that impressed by it in the end. We're now going to talk about Constellations at the Trafalgar Studios. This is Nick Payne's play, which was done at the Royal Court in 2013, had a successful West End run with Ralph Spall and Sally Hawkins. I believe is either just finished on Broadway or is currently on Broadway with Jake Gyllenhaal and Ruth Wilson. So it is a play that has gone around the world and come back. This current production has been on tour for a number of months, I think, and has finally come to the Trafalgar Studios. Tim, tell me about it and what you thought of it.
It's a difficult play to describe, first off, for maybe a couple of reasons. First of all, it is very much the sort of play where you really don't want to give away too much about the plot, because that's part of what makes it a very special piece of writing. And equally, you don't want to give, well, it's hard to give away much about the content, because Nick Payne has written a play which involves an incredibly intricate piece of plotting centered around the ideas of string theory. And I'm not probably the person who is going to be able to describe to anyone the intricacies of string theory. But effectively, putting all that aside, at its heart is a love story between two characters, Marianne and Roland, played in this production by Louise Brearley, who some may know from Sherlock, and Joe Armstrong. And they have taken over the roles which were originally played by Ray Spall and Sally Hawkins in the West End production, where it ran for a considerable amount of time and both critical and public acclaim. And it's fair to say that they are two big shoes to fill. It's always going to be difficult when characters are kind of associated with a starring role in the first run. And I think when I went to see this, although it has been touring for a while, it did feel that Joe Armstrong and Louise Brearley were still feeling their way into the parts to some extent. And I felt as the play went on that they got more and more confident and comfortable in their performances. Joe Armstrong in particular, I think as the play starts, he very much has to perform in an everyman kind of role, which is always challenging to do on stage when you want to perhaps find something a bit more extrovert in the character. And I really feel that he was having to dial it down to begin with. But as the play goes on and you see their relationship develop, it becomes quite a powerful piece. Now, so far, I've talked very much around what actually happens on stage, but effectively, Marianne plays a physicist and Roland plays a beekeeper. And all the play does in the space of 70 very tight minutes is tell you about their relationship, or possibly more accurately, the possible relationships they may have had through different times and different places and different universes. And that is very much how the play progresses from start to finish. You are constantly seeing scenes which are played out again and again with minor variations on a theme, and all of these tiny variations, kind of like the idea of the ripples across a ocean, or the idea of a butterfly effect, spark off and move the characters into slightly new directions. And if all this feels that it may be a bit dry and a bit tedious at times, that you're watching the same scenes play over again and again, I can only urge people who haven't seen the play before that really isn't the case. And that fundamentally comes down to the skill of Nick Payne's writing. This is the second time I've watched the play, and for those who have seen it before, I would definitely say it is a truly rewarding experience to go back and watch it again. I think the first time you watch it, it is such a fine, delicate structure that is woven across the theatre that you get absolutely caught up in trying to understand how what you're watching unfolding in front of you is going to piece itself together by the end. But with the benefit of hindsight, you can kind of sit back and allow yourself to observe the process of the story being created as much as you do watching the play. And it really is impossible not to admire the artistry of the construction as much as admiring the quality of the content. And if the first time when I watched it, I found it a very amusing play with quite a large heart within it, I think watching it a second time, the pathos of the play comes through far, far more strongly, and the more tragic elements which remain within it. And I don't want to say much more about that aspect because I think it would spoil the play if you haven't seen it before. But those slightly more tragic aspects come through much more strongly the second time round, possibly because you're spending less time trying to follow the content and more time being actually able to listen to what is being said. But that's my own opinion. And Julie, I don't know if you've got a different view.
I agree with lots that you've said. I didn't actually see it the first time round, so this was the first time that I've seen it. It was very satisfying, it's watching, and it is a kind of
play that you have to, as a member of the audience, really focus and concentrate on it. I'm interested in what you said about the two actors finding their way. I felt that a little bit, even though there was lots of possibilities, there were times when I didn't feel that they always connected with each other in a way that I would want them to. However, that's part of the play as well, because it could be one thing and it could be another thing without giving it away as well. What I thought was really good about it was, at first you just thought it's these incidents being played out in slightly different ways, and then you move on to the next one and then the next one, and you kind of choose your own ending and then move on to the next one. But when you're so far into it, you realise that it's not as linear as you think it is, that actually moments that have been played out earlier in the play have so much relevance later on, and you've got to be able to pick up on those, get the most out of it. So I absolutely love this, and I think, yeah, it was great for me. I love these hour plays, 70 minutes this was, where everything's really focused, the kind of thing they do at the Edinburgh Fringe, because sometimes I think plays can be just dragged out that little bit too much, and I think it's great that people have a go at these really tight dramas in this space of time. I didn't really like the venue for it. I was lucky I was on the front row, so I felt quite close to it, but that venue, I'm not sure how it might have felt if you were halfway or towards the back of it, whether it would feel as intense in that kind of very sloping bank of seats. But it was really worthwhile. I'd be interested to hear how it really differs, or was it very similar to the original that you both saw?
Actually, the staging and the set is basically identical to the original run. And Michael Longhurst is the same director who directed both of them. And Tom Scutt, who did the design, I believe did the design for the original as well. But as far as I could tell, it was pretty much identical. And it raised a question for me, which I can't actually answer, but whether the set itself, the stage design, is written into the play by Nick Payne, or whether that was a conscious decision of the director and design team. But because I've now seen it twice, with this very blank stage, this two actors, those kind of balloons which can fire like synapses, I think it would be very difficult now to watch this play staged in another way, because it seems so associated with this particular design. But Tim, I don't know if you've got a different opinion.
Yeah, I haven't seen this current production. It does always give me a slight pause when it's the same team coming back again, because I'm not sure that it really counts as a separate production in that sense. You know, you've still got the same sort of director-designer team, and they haven't changed anything. And it always slightly worries me. I get it much more with musicals, where you can sometimes sit in one of these big musicals that's got productions on all over the world and feel that they could simply transport you around and you might notice the difference, but they could sort of teleport you between different productions at almost the same moment and you get the same thing. So it does always worry me slightly that somebody hasn't come in, you know, nobody's going to come in yet and reinterpret the play. But given that when we first reviewed this, and we reviewed this in 2013 in August, and we were incredibly enthusiastic about it. I mean, perhaps this one is not quite as enthusiastic, because I think we had the freshness of having just seen a play which was in some ways magical. I think seeing it again, you're more concentrating on the actors and how they did it.
I think it's, for the actors, an enormous feat to be able to go through those different emotions and then have an emotional arc across the whole play. So shifting from one thing to the other in seconds, but being able to show a narrative arc, I think that's brilliant for the two actors to be able to sustain that. Must be quite a challenge.
Absolutely. And Julie, what you just said made me think one of the things about this play, which is quite impressive, is that I think it's very rare to find a play which is so much both an actor's play, which it really, really is. I mean, it's a goldmine of a role for an actor, really. There's so much you can do with it. But also, it's a writer's play as well. And as much space as the actors are given to act, they can only act within the tightly constrained space which Nick Payne's script gives them. So that alone, I think, makes it a very impressive play, one which kind of balances the abilities of the writer with really good acting roles.
We're now going to talk about Bugsy Malone, which has been on at the Lyric Hammersmith since April, but we've only just got around to seeing it, so unfortunately our reviewers might be a little bit rusty. This is an adaptation of the film, which was, I believe, written by Alan Parker with music and words by Paul Williams. So this is the Paul Williams who had a sort of a golden era in the late 70s. I think he pretty much wrote everything for a while. He was one of those composers who sort of writes everything, a bit like Burt Bacharach, that they get a sort of golden period of 5 years or so where every song you hear is probably written by them. And this is Paul Williams, who also appeared in one or two films. It tells of a gangster played by a child. The film, of course, has a wonderful cast of people like Jodie Foster and Scott Baio and some interesting other British actors, because it was filmed in Britain with one or two American stars, but you also got British stage school actors. I think one of the ones I know best is the actor and presenter Mark Curry, who was on Blue Peter once, and he's in the film somewhere. And I think Dexter Fletcher is as well. The film is certainly interesting, but it makes it rather difficult to stage when you have to have child actors. And there was a stage production of this some years ago. I think Gareth knows all about that. In the film, they solve the problem of the kids singing by using adult singers. And I think they did that in the first stage production. I don't think they do that here. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, just to sort of touch on the film a bit more before we talk about the show. I mean, it was Alan Parker's first film, and we know that Alan Parker went on to be a great film director. But up until this film, he actually was just doing adverts. And for some reason, he got this somewhat bizarre idea of making a gangster film with music that was performed entirely by children. So where you get that idea from, I really don't know, but he did. And it actually was a success. And even though he was by then a filmmaker, he did find time to write the book for a stage version. So he actually wrote the book for the stage version then and indeed now. It's his book, which had its premiere in 1983. So that was 32 years ago. And it actually was put on in the West End in the Her Majesty's Theatre before Phantom moved in. And the director of that production was Mickey Dolenz, who was the drummer in the Monkees. So it's, I think, quite an interesting kind of background, really. But it wasn't a big hit on stage at that time. It did run for a few months. But they did exactly the same in the stage show as they'd done in the film, in that they cast kids for all of the roles. So obviously they had more than one cast, but they actually had the music sung off stage by adults. So what they've done in this production is that they have cast the seven leads as kids at the appropriate age, and they have three casts, so they alternate. And then all the other roles are actually played by young professional actors who are sort of probably late teens, early 20s or whatever. So therefore, the singing is live, including the children, which I prefer, which is much better. Though I think it does lose something by having the young professional adults in what are effectively the roles that kids did in the original stage production and indeed in the film. It's a gang war between Fat Sam and Dandy Dan. And Bugsy is a kind of fringe player in this, really. And he falls for a kind of wannabe showgirl who's called Blousy. Fat Sam has a girlfriend called Tallulah, who also rather fancies Bugsy. And what Bugsy is doing is he's making money from Fat Sam. He's helping Fat Sam make money, which helps him get Blousy to Hollywood, which is her dream, really. But he has to also keep Tallulah at bay, and he has to keep Fat Sam ignorant of Tallulah's affections, just in case he gets blamed for that. Fat Sam runs a speakeasy, so we're in that period of prohibition. So lots of opportunities for song and dance routines. And indeed, Blousy auditions for Fat Sam, as does the cleaner, which is a lovely role called Fizzy, also auditions as part of the show. The music's, I think, quite tuneful and quite accessible. And on the night I went, clearly quite familiar, because some people were actually singing along. So a lot of people obviously had seen, suspect, the film rather than the first stage show. And the trademark of the film, as indeed the stage show, is that they use splurge guns and water instead of trying to sort of pretend that they're really shooting people. And that's kind of the trademark of the show, I think, really. I think it's great fun, to be honest. You know, it's perhaps not, I'm certainly not the sort of typical audience, but I did enjoy it. The rest of the audience was significantly more euphoric than I was, but that's more to do with who is aimed at, really. I think what's great about it is it's packing out the Lyric Hammersmith for 5 months. It's reopening the Lyric Hammersmith, which is a theatre that's very well known for its youth work, so it seems to be very appropriate. And, of course, it's creating lots of opportunities for kids, but also for young actors as well. I think it's very well staged. Sean Holmes, who's the director of the Lyric Hammersmith, directs the show itself, and I think he's done a good job of it. The cast we had on the night, because there were three for each role, I just thought were terrific. And I thought the ensemble work was really very good from the young professionals as well. And I think one of the highlights of the show is that Drew McConey has done some really great choreography, which is kind of quite fresh and quite exciting. And John Bowser. I mean, the design isn't particularly important, but the costumes, the sort of period gangster costumes, I think are particularly good, really. So I just think it's a good fun night. I think it's great for a young audience. And I think it's great to see the Lyric Hammersmith coming back with this, you know, something appropriate, being a theatre where young people have and will, I'm sure, continue to be very welcomed.
Tim, what did you think?
I think it was interesting when Gareth said he wasn't the target audience for it. I suspect that whilst it's aimed, obviously, at children, it's a very canny choice by the Lyric Hammersmith to reopen with this, because, of course, any children won't have actually grown up with Bugsy Malone, but, of course, their parents would have done. And this production is as much, I think, about satisfying the desires of parents as it is creating some sparkling entertainment and sugar rush pleasure for the children they take with them. Now, for me, at 32, I grew up in the age of the VHS generation, sort of the late 80s, early 90s, and films like Bugsy Malone and other kind of sort of classics of that era, of that kind of young adult age range, were played to destruction on my VHS player, sort of rewound and forward wound to the best bits. And as soon as I heard that they were going to do a staging of it in London, I booked tickets to go to see it. So it's possible I didn't go and see it with a completely critical eye attached. But then I think sometimes you do have to put those sensibilities aside. This is a show which is just enjoyable from start to finish. Michael Billington, when he reviewed it, did say that it didn't have anything new to say about the gangster movie, which, well, while being kind of factually correct, does kind of, I feel, miss the point of Bugsy Malone. It's effectively to musicals what a 18th century folly is to architecture. I don't think it really serves any other purpose than to be just enjoyed for what it is. The songs are toe-tapping and infectious, and if you don't leave the theatre humming "I Give a Little Love to Yourself" or the theme tune to Bad Guys, then I would be lost for words. The cast, as Gareth said, there were three of them, and on the night I saw it, they were absolutely brilliant. I find it remarkable that teenagers can take the stage with such assurance. And we had Eleanor Worthington Cox playing Blousy Brown, and incredibly, she already has one Olivier Award in her locker, because she was one of the original Matildas. And her rendition of "I'm Feeling Fine," which was one of the hit shows from the original film, is quite frankly exceptional. Her voice, as I believe she's 13 or 14, is quite stunning. And alongside her, we had James Okalaja playing Fat Sam. And he really does steal the show out from underneath everyone around him. Again, just a teenager, but with such confidence and with such stage presence. There are moments in the musical where he is on stage by himself, acting towards an entire room of adults and children in a professional production. And he is vibrant and energetic and full of confidence. And I have to say, able to deliver an absolutely marvelous comedy pratfall. And I was just absolutely stunned with both his quality, with Eleanor's quality, but also the quality across the entire cast, where you really don't feel that there are many weak links. Now, of course, it is interesting because I have no idea what it would be like to see it with one of the other casts. But what I could say is that anyone who does have children and is looking for something to do over the summer holidays, the tickets for Bugsy Malone, a top price of £40. And when you compare that to the cost of musicals in the more mainstream West End, you are effectively paying half the price. So it really, really is a great night out, which I'd recommend to anyone.
We're now going to talk about As Is at the Trafalgar Studios. This is William M. Hoffman's 1985 play, which I think is rumoured to be the first sort of play to really deal with AIDS, as it beat Larry Kramer's play The Normal Heart by a few months. I mean, not that there should be too much of a competition of it. Now, this production is built from the production they had at the Finborough in 2013, but only transfers across one of the actors from that particular production, and I think they've changed the design slightly. This play is about the AIDS epidemic. It is what we felt when we first looked at it back in 2013 was that it was a very immediate play and therefore had dated more than other plays that have had more time to look at the situation and really go over everything about the whole AIDS epidemic. This was very immediate. The concerns were very major, and these concerns perhaps melted away later, and maybe melted away for good reasons later. But the actual concerns he was talking about in As Is were very, very current when the play was written and when the play was first staged. Gareth, what did you think about this production?
Well, the first thing that sort of strikes you is it's 30 years since the onset of AIDS and 30 years since this play, which is just, for me, just seems quite extraordinary, really. It just feels a lot less. And as you say, it was the first play to cover the events and issues of that time. I didn't feel, even though it's dated in the sense of behavior and costumes and all of that, I think the play is good enough. And it's kind of survived the test of time as a good play. So despite the period, I actually think that it does speak to a sort of audience, but in a different way, because the issues today are more about surviving with HIV rather than, you know, what was inevitable 30 years ago, or almost inevitable, was of course death. And at the core of the play, there's this personal story about a writer called Rich, who's played by Stephen Webb. And he's a New York City gay man. He's a writer. He's got a partner who's a Jewish photographer. It's called Saul, who's David Pointner, who transfers from the Finborough production, I understand. And he cheats on Saul with his best friend Lily's younger brother, Chet, and then is diagnosed with AIDS, I think after that rather than before that. But Saul remains loyal to Rich and throughout his illness cares for him. And, you know, that's the kind of personal story at the core of the play. But the play is much more than the personal story, because the play is really bringing in all of the issues that the disease raises, and they're interwoven into the personal story. So it's not sort of separated out. They're sort of interwoven in between him in a series of ensembles that I thought were really quite masterly in the way they're staged. And the first one, which covers the attitudes to the disease. You will recall that at the time it was kind of, I think the Sun called it, or something called it, the gay plague. And a lot of these attitudes are very uninformed and very ignorant. And that scene is quite shocking, really, because it reminds you of the attitudes of the time. And it's brilliant the way it's kind of staged, where sort of different characters sort of come forward and sort of give us their views. And they might be friends, relatives, or complete strangers or members of the public or whatever, really. And some of the other ensembles kind of, you know, illustrate the sort of the gay scene, as it were, the sort of promiscuity that had at that time. We have a therapy session. So we, you know, we have an ensemble scene that deals with people in a group therapy session who are sufferers. And there's a helpline scene, which actually only involves two of the actors, but is frankly hysterical with these two men running a helpline. And that's the great thing about the play, really, is because it's actually you know, this sounds a bit odd, but it's actually entertaining and funny. So it's not earnest. It's sort of, even though it's a serious subject and treats the subject seriously, it does it in a way that actually makes it an experience that's not depressing, but actually is enjoyable. The scenes in the hospice are particularly moving, but over only about 80 minutes, you know, it does cover an awful lot, and it is a very well-structured and a very, very well-written play, which is why I say that it stood the test of time, because even 30 years on from the events it represents, I still feel it's a good piece of work, and I think the main reason for going to see it is it's just good theatre. I think the key to the success for me in this production is the casting, because, I mean, there wasn't a fault in the casting. I mean, Stephen Weber's Rich and David Poynter-Saul, I thought, were really excellent. And then you've got these six other actors, Natalie Burt, Bevan Celestine, Giles Cooper, Dino Fetcher, Jane Lowe, and Russell Morton, who play between them, I don't know, 30 roles, I think, in total. And you'd be hard-pressed to find a better ensemble on a stage, really. It's very well designed by Tim McQuillan Wright. It's got very good period costumes by Philip Bennett. And there's very atmospheric lighting and music. I think Neil Brinkworth does the lighting and Matthew Strachan does the music. And all of these things allow a kind of, you know, allow it to move between the scenes, really. Directed as it was at the Finborough by Andrew Keats. And I think he's in this less intimate but still intimate space. You know, it's got great pace. It actually engages the audience throughout. And there's lots of sort of direct eye contact with the audience, but also involves the audience, not in a sort of tacky way, but it does kind of engage with the audience in terms of direct contact occasionally. So I thought it was a terrific revival, frankly, and we recently had another AIDS play revived, which is My Night with Reg, which also stood the test of time, but is a completely different play. And they both come out for me as proving that, you know, they stay with us and I'm no doubt will be seen again. What I liked a lot about this particular run is because, you know, HIV is still an issue and albeit a bit of a different issue, that what they've decided to do is they've decided to have around the play, to have Q&As and talks and free HIV testing. And there's the theatre itself is a kind of remembrance wall that you're free to write on. And I just thought that was great, that it kind of opens up the subject and you know, as theatre does other things, it actually, you know, engages with the issues to a modern day audience. And the night I went, it was the playwright Martin Sherman, who is another gay playwright who wrote Bent and then other plays like Rose and Madhouse and Go and so on. And he was sort of at the Q&A there, which for me was a bonus because, you know, he's a very interesting playwright too. And I was interested to, you know, to hear him talk. But it wasn't just him. It was him with Andrew Keats and indeed with Stephen Webb in the Q&A. So, I mean, it's so long ago when I first saw it. Making comparisons 30 years ago is impossible. But for what it is today, I thought it was very much a must-see revival. And I think of what is a very important play. So for me to be seen, it's only got, I think it only runs till the 1st of August, but it should be seen because it's good theatre. So very much a recommendation from me.
We did feel at the time that there is a slight problem that you have with anything that treats on AIDS these days, unless you can really dress it up the way that My Night with Reg was, you know, with a big star cast, you're not necessarily going to get people interested in it, which is a pity because, as you say, it's a good play and it's, but people think, yes, it's all, you know, it almost as if AIDS has been cured. Of course, it hasn't been. It's treatable. It's not curable. It's not in any way being cured, and it's still a major problem in other parts of the world. And possibly a major problem here, because, I mean, the people with AIDS have still got it. So, you know, at least they're still alive. But in the public consciousness, I feel that it's a very much a side issue. It's moved across to other places. And we don't remember it as much as this, because this play is very much puts you, it's not trying to have a long view and have context like a play like perhaps Angels in America did. It's more that immediate reaction. And there's always a risk when you do something which is immediate that somehow you lose a lot. But it does look like you don't think that that's happened in this case.
But it is still a big issue. I mean, it is still a big issue in the developed world, as you say, more about survival than it is about loss. But, you know, I mean, there are tens of millions of people who died of this disease in Africa, and that's still happening today with huge percentages of the African population being HIV. It's a pity that we don't engage with it because it's still a disease that's ravaging the world, as it were. But anyway, from the play's point of view, I think it's very much a recommendation, isn't it?
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page of Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.